Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit by WFPL.
Welcome back to listeners. As I always say, another exciting show for y'all. We are going to have a feature interview with Jen Jackson, who wrote a really wonderful piece for Washington Post about what it means to her to be a queer Black mother. And that's going to be really kind of fascinating. And falls right in line with my campaign to get you and Missy to have some kids.
Because,
just hold that thought. We'll come back to it. But in the meantime, y'all, we're going to do another exciting edition of Juicy Fruit. And joining us is our guest on Juicy Fruit this week. Well, not even really a guest anymore because they're part of the team. Welcome, the intern, Brandon.
Thank you.
Now, Brandon, today the ball is in his proverbial court because most of our topics are about sports. Mm-hmm. And y'all know that it's outside of my purview. If it ain't about...
And it's really outside of mine, too.
At least you were an athlete, though. At least you did shot put.
Oh, my God, like in college and high school.
But still, that's closer than me. I, like, jumped over double dutch when I was in grade school. if it's not Jason Collins or Michael Sam, I don't know about it. So, Brandon, you have brought with us a couple of hot topics, but we're gonna start at ESPN, which is the sports version of like MTV, right?
I don't know about that. But okay, they are the epicenter of sports.
Though. Okay, there we go. So what's happening over there? But that's some breaking news that involves one of their one of their Black, I guess,
hosts.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, the story is about Jemele Hill, who's a former host of His and Hers with Michael Smith. And I believe the show is currently called The Six. And she, I'm believing it's a tweet, said that Trump is a white supremacist and he surrounded himself with white supremacists.
Yeah, she tweeted September 11th of last week. She said, Donald Trump's a white supremacist.
Oh, and she tweeted it September 11th?
Yeah, September 11th, yeah.
That's not the time they want you to do it.
And right, I know, what a day. And so she talked about Trump being ignorant and offensive and that, that his rise to fame is because of white supremacy.
Yes. Yeah.
And so people were unhappy about that, Brandon? What happened?
People are unhappy about that, of course. ESPN, I'm not sure what they have done. I know they came out basically said that, her opinions are of her own. They do not represent the company.
Okay.
And the White House has said that is a fireable. Those words are fireable.
So, So the what's her name? Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who's the new press secretary.
It was like
the
100th, they actually had a press conference for it. It
was Donald 45, excuse me, has press conferences for every daggone thing. Mm. But
I know this is like to me the most press conference presidency ever seen.
Yeah,
it's almost like Donald Trump about to speak. Donald Trump about to speak. 45 about to speak. It's like what?
Well, the weird thing is that he's trying to operate like a king.
A tyrant.
Right. I mean, was it Spence? I think is it Spence? He's fired now, right?
Oh yeah, Sean Spicer.
Spicer,
the previous press secretary.
At the time when he said people have to understand that the president's power will not be questioned. And that doesn't make no sense because you're a president, not a king. If you were a king, especially in monarch times, then I would agree with that. But you're a president, checks and balances.
I agree.
And the president's job is essentially to represent and work for
you're
the
CEO.
People.
You're more of a CEO.
Well, in this case, you think he's a dictator. So you're right, Brandon. So Sarah Sanders said the quote, "This is one of the most outrageous comments that anybody could make. And certainly it's something that is a fireable offense by ESPN." And so, they're trying to get Jemele fired. Mm-hmm. But what have other athletes been saying? Are there people who have come to her defense?
To my knowledge, Colin Kaepernick, of course, he's still behind.
That's Bay.
He's still behind her. But I mean, I haven't really heard any other athletes. I'm pretty sure they are though.
Yeah. Mm. I guess that this brings into question the larger issue around like athletes and people who work in the athletic arena speaking out against it.
And I think that again there have been, and Brandon can certainly speak to this too, I mean historically and clearly with Kaepernick and with her as well as an ESPN correspondent, athletes are speaking out against oppressive regimes and discrimination and those types of things. It's not to say that when they do, there are not consequences, right? But what it does show is that when there are consequences for speaking out against injustice, what does that say to you, Brandon? What does it say to you that no team is trying to hire Kaepernick? What does it say to you that the White House is calling for this correspondent to be fired?
Well, I think what it says is that in a way, they're not doing it on purpose, but it's almost proving them right. Yeah. If I say that white supremacy is alive and well, and then I lose my job because of it, well, what does that prove?
Absolutely.
I mean, if it's not, and on top of that, I mean, the mindset is that people are saying that all white people are racist or that all white people are some type of evil.
Yeah.
They're not. That's not the case.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But I do think that people are saying from a systemic standpoint that we as Black people or any other oppressed group in American history or world history for that matter, have to deal with it.
Absolutely.
It's something that's real.
I think that to me, like in terms of what's next, I mean, there's that whole movement, like the boycott the NFL movement. Like to me, I wonder how powerful it would be, right? So if Jamel gets fired, or if Colin Kaepernick doesn't get a job, if every black athlete in whatever arena, so if you're a basketball player, mm-hmm. if you're a football player, say we're not playing this next game coming up mm-hmm. until mm-hmm. A list of demands.
It would mean something, because that's the main reason that Colin Kaepernick is not being hired, because they're saying that he would affect ticket sales and mm-hmm. ratings have went down since these protests have been going on.
But my thing is, let's keep it real, y'all. I mean, it's like the new version of enslavement to some degree, right? I mean, but they want these black bodies, these black athletes, but they want them to be quiet. They don't want them to talk back, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want you to get out of your place. And so I just wonder, what would it look like if every big time athlete decided to stand in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick or Jamel Hill and say, we are not going to play another game until you all do this, until you all be in the industry, does this and this differently.
You know, the amazing thing about that is it's kind of like they're hypocritical to an extent, because when Michael Jordan didn't stand up for nothing, he gets criticized for it. But yet, if we get a Colin Kaepernick or Muhammad Ali,
he gets criticized as well.
So it's damn if you do, damn if you don't.
It's also damned or owned Michael Jordan. So it's like, I mean, I agree with you that you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. But again, I have a great deal more respect for Colin Kaepernick. You know, I don't care. I'm out of the sport, so I don't care about how cool Michael Jordan was on the. But what I do care about is the fact that he refused to use his power and his money and his influence to help the lives of the people around him. Mm-hmm. No respect there. No respect at all. So I, you know,
right.
I expect athletes to do better, right? Like for me, like you have nothing to lose. You already got multi-millions of dollars.
But it's a different expectation though. Because you expect them to help, and they expect them to shut up and play ball. You see what I'm saying? So it's a different mindset.
I get that, Brandon. But so on my job, right? If I make $40,000 a year, $50,000 a year, and I do something wrong and I get fired, that's going to significantly gonna impact my pockets.
For sure.
If you're already a multimillionaire, if you already have $20 million in the bank, and say you lose an endorsement that's worth another $5 million, now, again, I know that everything is relative, but for me, the risk factors are much lower for these celebrities.
True.
You know, what they stand to lose is significantly lower. You know, and so for me, I just don't buy the argument that they're somehow torn, or they somehow have to appease or accommodate, you know, their owners or their managers. So it's like, no, at some point you got to stand up for what you believe.
That is true. That is true. I'd agree with that.
Yeah. We wanted to switch gears, Doc, because you are really excited about one woman named Sloane Stephens.
Yes.
Tell us about her.
So Sloane Stephens actually won the U.S. Open, and I just think she's so cute. And she gave her, she basically beat her really good friend.
Yeah,
and
Madison Keys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so after she won, she like gave her this really, really long hug, and I loved that. And it just seems like they support one another, even though Sloane won and her friend didn't. But the thing that cracked me up was when they presented her with that $1 million, that $3 million.
How much did she get?
Oh, like 3.8 something million. Yeah. I mean, if she was gaggy, honey. I mean, the thing that would crack
me
up.
If I had known
those
to pay, I would have paid much more attention while I was hooking in tennis.
And I think they said she had only had up to like her winnings was like 200,000 up to that point.
She looked at that check, it's like, listeners, pull it up on YouTube or, try to find it on Facebook. I mean, her face, she was looking at them like, for real? Like,
is this my money?
Oh, my God. Yeah, so I just thought that was so, it was almost like,
I wonder, when people win, like, Brandon, you might know, when people win, like, championships and stuff and they get money, do they get that money, like, instantly? Like, so will they, like, wire that money to your account the same day? Or you have to, like, wait a couple weeks?
It depends.
Weeks?
Like, in boxing, like, a lot of times they let you choose what you want. So, like, but I would wager, like Mayweather, he made $300 million.
He was on his plane the next day, like, with a suitcase full of cash. Like, did he leave a cash duck is that same day? Or you have to, like, wait for it to get...
Usually they wire it. But, like, in a payment. So, like, if you get a $30 million for a fight, like, I remember, like, Mayweather, he had fought De La Hoya in 2007. Okay. 2013, he was still getting checks from that fight.
Oh, so it's sort of like annuities.
Wow.
Like, so much per.
So like Publishers Clearinghouse, like give you something. No.
Girl, that's not even still around. Is that still around?
Yes.
Did you used to do those things?
First of all, my mom used
and they,
to do
they would send you all the little...
My mom, you had to subscribe to magazines, basically. Yep. It was like a scam.
I did it every time.
And my mom, when I was younger, she would mail away from it. But now they have PCH.com.
Yeah, but you do it all online.
Yeah, but they claim they show up to your
house. I just don't believe it. I've never known anybody
like
who has ever really won.
I've never known anybody either. I'm like, are these people actors? Right. Are people really winning? Like, I don't believe it at all. But
that is so interesting. But Sloane Stephens, and so the best meme I saw was a meme about was it what Serena? Who's having the baby? Serena or Venus?
Serena.
Yeah, and it was like Serena sat down to have a baby, and another black woman stepped in to make sure the beat didn't skip. You know, like the notion of Venus being that number one black woman tennis player, and then she's taking a break to have a baby.
Yeah,
and here comes Sloane Stephens. So it's just been a whole, I guess, little season of black woman magic. Before we go, our friend Terrell Alvin McCraney.
Yes.
Met with Oprah.
Yes. Mm.
About
his new TV series, and I'm so excited about it because, as you know, Terrell's a friend to the show. We love Terrell. Anything that Terrell does, we're always, like, here for. So it's an untitled series, but it's essentially a series that is a coming-of-age drama that's inspired by Terrell's life experiences. And it's part of OWN's expanded 2018 lineup of scripted programming and will be executive produced by Michael B. Jordan with Mike Kelly and Melissa Lowe. Who are the production team behind Revenge, I guess. And the thing that I love about it is, even though it's not based on Moonlight, we all know that Moonlight is part and parcel based on
Terrell's life.
Terrell's growing up as well. Him in conjunction with Barry Jenkins, who was the film's director.
Yeah.
So it was kind of an amalgamation and mashup of their growing up and their adolescence. And so I'm just all about this new series. I can't wait to watch it. So, you know, OWN is having a lot of series that I'm just obsessed with. I mean, Queen Sugar, and now they're going to have, you know,
Terrell's new thing.
Okay, I love it.
Do you think that he needs like some guest actors, or do you think he's still casting for like a lead? Like, you know, like if there's like a,
I mean, I don't know.
Like,
but
like a modeling handsome salt and pepper black gay man with
locks. I just want to know what period of time. I want to know what period of time it takes place, because I'm like, okay, so if it takes place, the series takes place in college, or like, who's going to play me?
Oh, girl. See, I thought I was dramatic. You're really dramatic.
I mean,
oh,
I
my goodness.
So, yeah, I probably, you know, won't be.
But if it's contemporary, then it could also, we would also still be in it. Because whenever we interviewed him for Strange Fruit back in our early years, who would play us? I feel
like. Well, exactly. Well, of course, for me, Lisa Nicole Carson.
And for me, Denzel Washington.
Would it be Denzel? would it be Denzel?
Would not be Denzel?
I mean, I definitely would be Lisa Nicole Carson, but would it be Denzel?
Who would it be?
I mean, I don't know.
Denzel, thank you. Brandon, who will play
Denzel is too old to play
Will Smith. Oh, Brandon, who will play you in the movie of your life? Who will play you?
I don't know. You know, it's so weird, man. People call me Idris Elba, so I don't know. I don't see it.
That was a humble brag. People call me Idris Elba.
I'm not even being cocky, man.
I can see that, but my thing is,
as all of our listeners go to Google and try to find Brandon's picture, like Idris Elba, let's see what he is.
But he's too old as well to play you.
Well, listeners, you tell us, who would play us in the story of Strange Fruit? Who would play the four of us? Who would play Laura?
People better not say Queen Latifah for me. People better not say Queen Latifah for me.
Girl, anybody's definitely going to say no Queen Latifah.
Well, child, people be saying it.
Who will play Laura? Who will play Brandon? Who will play Doc? Who will play me? Send us a Twitter show ideas, and maybe if you're a screenwriter out there, you can like maybe like pitch us a sitcom as we, you know, the story of Strange Fruit. So, as you all know, Doc is I guess you're still a newlywed, yes? I mean, you've been married about...
No.
I mean, no, you're a newlywed child. You've been married for like, what, a year and a half? Like
only 1 year and, so and a couple months.
Well, how long is one a newlywed? Like, how long does that...
I feel like
5 years.
No, I feel like 1 year.
No, it's not a 1 year child.
Okay,
but nevertheless, and so, I want to be Uncle Jay. So I've been encouraging you and Missy, you need to have some babies.
Yeah.
I want to be an uncle again. And so so I'm really fascinated, all that to say, with parenting and you know, just wondering, the wondrous ways that people who are queer people and trans people can be parents. And so that was a really cool essay I read on Washington Post by a wonderful writer named Jen, and it was all about being a queer parent. So please welcome to the show one Jen Jackson. How are you, Jen?
Hi. How are you?
Wonderful. Now, you are a doctoral candidate. You're a writer. You're the managing editor for Black Youth Project. But this particular piece you wrote for Washington Post was titled "Why Mothering as a Queer Black Woman is Inherently Political." And so there might be people who say, well, how is being a parent political? How is being a black queer parent political? Give us the some about your thought process. What were you thinking when you wrote that, and what did you want to highlight in this piece?
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, thank you for having me today.
Yeah.
But the piece was an essay. It was kind of a primer on how I go about parenting my children. And I'm actually in what is usually read as a heterosexual couple.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm a bisexual woman. I'm a 6'4" tall woman, which is also kind of a queer body for thinking of femininity and how we move throughout the world in bodies that are seen as women.
Mm-hmm.
And so what ends up happening a lot for me as a tall, darker-skinned Black woman who identifies as bisexual, is that I'm placed in situations and conditions that I don't necessarily volunteer or consent to, right? Mm-hmm. And that's happened all through, like, my childhood as I've grown up. And I realized that a lot of those conditions were out of my control, and I didn't want my children to go through the same situation.
Yeah.
So the essay is really talking about how I've worked through those situations in my personal life and what it's meant for how I try to break down gender roles and gender normativity for my children at home and what that means for how they now interact with the world.
I love it. I love it.
I love it. I mean, I mean, the thing I really, really appreciated about your piece, and for me, even though I'm not interested in ever having kids, so no, Jay, no uncle status at all. But the thing I really appreciate about your piece is all of the dialogue that you have in there in the article with your son and all the things that they kind of learn in school that reinforce these really, really rigid roles about femininity, masculinity, maleness, boyness,
right,
girl clothes, boy clothes, and how you are really deliberately usurping all of those things. I mean, because by the time I get students in college, they have come from these households that really try to box their identity, their aesthetic, their style, and really hone in on real reductive ideas around who they could possibly become. And so I really appreciated the dialogue that you shared in your piece. Could you tell some of our audience members some of the conversations, maybe that you didn't share in your piece, but just some conversations between you and your children around.
And how you all work through the, in unpacking these kind of issues, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's kind of funny you say that because we had one just last night. And it was kind of uncomfortable. We were watching a family-oriented television show, and I'm not going to call it out, but it's a prominent show that lots of people watch.
Yeah.
And they were using some pretty strong, transphobic, homo-antagonistic language. Mm. And for me, it was very disconcerting. And my 9-year-old looks over at me, and he's like, "What does that mean, Mommy? Explain that to me." So we had a whole conversation about trans identity and understanding how, you know, someone doesn't become a man, doesn't start off as a woman and become a man. Someone doesn't start off as a man and become a woman. And that gender, the way that we understand gender, is too often the way that we project gender onto other people's bodies without their consent. So he's talking to me. We talked about the difference between understanding gender reassignment surgery and why that's problematic versus surgeries that folks use to actually assert their correct gender, because we as a society have wrongly assigned gender.
Yeah.
And so we had this conversation, over chicken and green beans. And I think that that's what's important to do. It's important to make those conversations normal and to make the behaviors that we're talking about abnormal, so that he looks at those and goes, "Wow, that makes no sense." But then at the end of our conversation, he just says, "Okay," which is what he did.
I love that. So you grew up, you mentioned in your essay that you've known you were queer since you were 9 years old. Talk to us a bit about about how you grew up. Did you go to Christian school? Were your folks conservative? I know you mentioned what it was like being against convention. Yeah, talk more about that.
Oh, goodness.
Yes.
I grew up in a very Christian household. And my grandmother is a very kind of devout Christian pastor. So you can imagine what that meant for me. So I didn't actually discover popular culture until I was 14. So I'm I missed most of Black culture because it was secular until 1996.
Yeah.
So I miss all of Janet Jackson's Control.
You miss Martin. You miss In Living Color. Yeah. All that.
Now listen, I caught In Living Color and Martin. I caught TV.
Okay.
Because my mom would watch it on the sly. So I caught that. But the stuff of the world, I wasn't really allowed to engage in. And I went to Catholic school at a predominantly white Catholic school. So I kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. Here I am, I was 5'5" at 8 years old, in this kind of queer body, clearly into my female classmates more than my male classmates at a Catholic school in Oakland, California.
No.
So it was interesting. And I think the reason why I was able to kind of tap into my identity the way I did was because my mother was very, what's the word? She didn't identify as feminist. but she knew who Angela Davis was. Mm. She had read, you know, Assata Shakur's work. She had been very close to the Black Panthers and kind of understood the antagonism she had toward male leadership. So she had questions about her identity as a woman, as a Black woman, and also toward, like, Black male leadership in the church. So I was already at a point where I could have those conversations, and she wasn't judging me because of it. You know, she wanted to have the conversations with me. And I think that opened up a lot of investigation and exploration for me and my identity.
That is so awesome. What about parenting, like in terms of discussing parenting with your partner, right? And how did that conversation go? Like, I want to be mindful of the way in which we raise our children together, and our children should be raised with open-mindedness and acceptance, right? So how did that conversation kind of play out when you guys were discussing how you guys were going to raise your children?
That's a great question.
Well, what's interesting about my relationship is that I actually met him when I was 17, and I was always very clear about my sexuality and my gender and how I move throughout the world. So when he met me, I was wearing an Echo Unlimited tracksuit. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was like, yo, this is who I am.
Yes.
And we were not in a romantic relationship. So I was able to talk to him about my relationships with multiple genders. And he kind of understood that as who I was and who I was going to be. So then when our relationship became romantic, it wasn't a surprise. Mm. And he had an understanding that this was going to be something that was going to be the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't a phase. So when we decided to have children, we actually didn't have a conversation because this is who I am, and he married who I am, and he wants to have children with the person that I am. So we kind of just lived our lives.
Yeah.
And because he's not... I would never couple with somebody who was patriarchal and misogynistic. And so for me, it was like, if that's who you are, we're not going to be together anyway.
Yeah.
And so our kids are not going to have that in their household. And so we never had to have a difficult conversation about how to raise the kids because he was already in a mindset where it's like, yeah, I don't want them to learn that stuff either. And he was raised by a mother like that too. I mean, he was raised by a mother who was very independent. He didn't have patriarchy in his household. He didn't have a man around to kind of reinforce problematic ideas about masculinity and things like that. And he's never been a person who needed to rely on those gender ideals to assert his manhood.
All right. You got you on the good ones.
Oh, I just love that. I just love that so much.
Yeah.
What would be your advice to parents who are inspired by you all's courtship and story and also the way in which you're deliberately parenting in a way that's going to create a better world? What would be some kind of baby steps for some parents
tips
out,
like,
there?
Where do you start? How do you begin to have those difficult conversations about what are boy clothes, what are girl clothes, what, you know, to breaking down gender toys and and those kinds of things? What advice do you have?
I mean, honestly, I was reflecting on that before this conversation because I was thinking, like, what would be the most important thing that I want to come out of this? And I think it's that we should trust children. Right, we do a lot of, like, protecting kids, but in protecting, what we really end up doing is wanting them and not allowing them to grow and be and not be whole human beings, right? And so kids are actually capable of understanding and working through a lot of complex things that we don't give them credit for, and then they grow up to become these kind of problematic adults because we haven't really actually given them access to their bodies and their identities and the full kind of way that they can move throughout the world. So for me, it's, you know, it's never too early to teach children about themselves, about others, and about the conditions within which we all live, love, and struggle each day. That's what's important to me. And I think for people who are starting out having children for the first time or who want to have children, to really get started is just to get started. Have that first conversation. And you understand your child. Kids have different levels of maturity, so you use the language and the terms that they're ready for, but have the conversation.
I love that. There are those people who might say, Jen, like, you should let kids be kids. Like, don't, you know, the kids can't, you know, they can't take all this, you know, this politically correct or this left wing or this liberal, this or that. You know, they're, what do you say to those people who say that you, by trying to do this brand of parenting, are somehow making your kids politicized or you giving them ideas they can't handle, when you should just let kids be kids, let boys be boys, so to speak? What do you say to that?
Here's the thing, especially for kids of color, black kids in this country. You know, Tamir Rice was murdered on a playground playing with a toy. Mm. Ayanna Stanley Jones was murdered in a living room on a couch sleeping with her grandmother. You know, these are children who, it doesn't matter what they're doing, they become politicized whether they decide to or not. Right? And so for me, I think that's a cute idea, but it's also, to me, very anti-black. And I think we have to have conversations around how that kids be kids thing is not conditioned on race or gender. There are little girls in this country who are sexually violated, who are touched without their consent, who are taught that their aunties, uncles, cousins have access to their bodies in ways that they don't like, right? That's politicizing them. That's teaching them that people have access to their bodies. And so if we don't counter those messages, we are doing harm. So what I'm doing with my kids is not politicizing them, right? What I'm doing with my kids is not creating a problem. I'm correcting a societal issue that we have that conditions children to believe that there's something wrong with being queer or trans or being female, right? So I'm actually working against pressures that teach my children not to be whole, responsible adults. So I'm not politicizing them at all.
I love it. I love it. Doc, I mean, you would agree, right? And I think what I appreciate about what both of you all are saying is that we have to begin to trust children, that trust that children can have sophisticated ideas, right?
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That children can understand sophisticated thoughts. And I think that that you all are both right, that you're right, Jen. And Doc, you talk about this in your classes, the ways in which, you know, black young people have had to mature faster, have had to handle some very complex issues, especially when it comes to issues of race, right? That parents have to have the talk with your young black boy at 9 years old. And so I agree that when it comes to race, we certainly have a quote-unquote adult conversation with children. So I think it's also appropriate that we begin to have more sophisticated, more nuanced conversations with young people around sexuality, gender identity as well. You agree, Doc?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that children are open and they're receptive and they're ready to talk about identity and everything under the sun. I think that it's actually the adults who limit the possibility of children.
Right.
I really do. I mean, so I completely agree.
What, Jen, I mean, do you have it all together, or are there some places? I guess parenting is never perfect, right? But where, if you want to be transparent, like, where are some places that you still see growth for yourself? Does it ever become uncomfortable or uneasy for yourself, or are you that parent who has it all together?
I wish. I have a whole podcast dedicated to how I don't have it all together.
All right. Yeah.
But no, like, I think the thing is, like, I'm okay with making mistakes, and I'm okay with not being that good at this. You know, and I'm also upfront with my kids about that. I tell my oldest all the time, like, you know, you are a practice baby, and I'm sorry.
Hey, I'm the oldest, so like, I get that. Yeah,
so
I'm
much.
The oldest. I understand what you mean.
Like, he's wonderful, and he's brilliant, and I'm always impressed with him. But I'm just like, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. And we did our best, and we're always going to do our best. But I check in with him, and I check in with my 6-year-old and my 3-year-old, you know, like, on the terms, again, the terms that they can understand. And I don't have it all together, but I'm working as a parent with intention. And I don't let the world raise my children for me. I don't let the TV tell my kids about gender. You know, there's these movies out here that will tell kids that, you know, gender is binary.
Mm-hmm.
And we just watched one just the other day that showed kids that, you know, it's either male or female, and that's it.
Yeah.
And it's pink and blue, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the kind of stuff that I have to actively work against, and I have to do that with intention. So it's not that I have it together, but it's that I have to do the best I can each day to ensure that I'm intentionally pushing back against the things that I know that can harm my children.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, right on. I love it. You know, it has been great chatting with you, but before you go, as you mentioned earlier, you have your own podcast. You know, we're hashtag team podcast in color. So tell our listeners what your podcast is called, where they can find it, and what you all talk about.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. So our podcast is That Black Couple. You can find us at thatblackcouple.com. We're on Stitcher, Google Play, SoundCloud. And it's actually me and my partner talking about this stuff.
All right. So all right, listen. So if you want some more, if you want to follow Jen and get some more parenting advice and figure out the ways in which Jen and her partner navigate this whole parenting thing, be sure to check them out. Hey, Jen, thank you so much for joining us today, and please be well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. So all of our thanks to Jen, all of our thanks to Brandon for sticking around for Juicy Fruit. It's been cool having an intern around here, y'all. We got some really wonderful stuff in the works for the Halloween season, so be sure to stick around for that. But before we go, we wanted to tell you all about another podcast from the Louisville Public Media family. It's called The Guest List. It's hosted by Sean Cannon. And in The Guest List, Sean talks to musicians, comedians, actors, authors, and other people. And he says it's like making a new friend at the bar, and you find out that they're in your favorite band. So y'all be sure to check out The Guest List at WFPL.org. We're out of time for now. Brandon, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media in Louisville, Kentucky. Our producer is Laura Ellis. Our intern is Brandon Beasley.
The views presented on Strange Fruit do not represent those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. Our executive producers are me, Jason Gardner.
And me, Kyla Story.
Thanks for listening.